We had more riveting testimony in the impeachment inquiry today. State Department official David Holmes testified that he was shocked to learn that U.S. military aid to Ukraine had been withheld, that the order had come from President Trump, and his clear impression was that it was to extract investigations of Trump's political rival Joe Biden. And Trump's former Russia advisor Fiona Hill testified that the false conspiracy theory pushed by some Republicans that it was somehow Ukraine, not Russia, that hacked the 2016 U.S. elections was helping Russia undermine American democracy.
I refuse to be part of an effort to legitimize an alternate narrative that the Ukrainian government is a U.S. adversary and that Ukraine, not Russia, attacked us in 2016.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has been following all of this. So tell us, both witnesses had already given closed-door testimony, and those transcripts came out a few days ago. But tell us more about seeing them in the flesh today.
Well, it was very powerful to see them in this flesh, particularly David Holmes. He's the political consultant at the U.S. Embassy, and talking about how he heard this investigation from President these calls for an investigation, overhearing this call when President Trump was having a discussion with Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the EU, seeing this in person, seeing Fiona Hill and hearing her talk about her own immigrant story. All that was very powerful.
Yeah. And you mentioned the phone call that President Trump made to Gordon Sondland and David Holmes' memory of that. Now, President Trump has already tweeted out about David Holmes' claim that he could hear this. David Holmes is a political consultant at the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. He said he heard this loud phone call between Trump and Sondland at a Kiev restaurant. And he said afterwards, he immediately asked Sondland about what he overheard.
In particular, I asked Ambassador Sondland if it was true that the president did not give a expletive about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland agreed that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. I asked why not. And Ambassador Sondland stated that the president only cares about big stuff. I noted there was big stuff going on in Ukraine, like a war with Russia. And Ambassador Sondland replied that he meant big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing.
And remember, David Holmes said that what he heard in that call was the president saying to Sondland, you know, am I going to get my investigations? And this is when Sondland said, the president of Ukraine loves your, you know, expletive. Now, Trump has tweeted out, it's impossible to overhear a phone call. And now people all over cable news are demonstrating that you can, in fact, overhear calls on phones. But how does this fit into the bigger puzzle?
Well, it's significant because it speaks more directly to the question of whether President Trump had knowledge of whether senior officials about what they were doing and regarding the push for this investigation. One of the White House's main arguments, one of their main defenses, has been that the testimony we've heard so far is largely hearsay and based on presumption and even guesses. In this case, David Holmes is very clear, and he says that he could hear President Trump's voice asking about a quote-unquote investigation.
Yeah. Look, we have not yet heard from Republicans. They're taking a break. They recessed so that members could cast votes on the floor. But we know that in his opening comments, Devin Nunes reacted to Fiona Hill's charge in her opening statement that some of them were, some of the people on the panel, were pushing this false narrative. What did he say in his opening remarks?
Well, he said that they were not pushing this false narrative. He said that they had actually conducted an investigation and had some of his staffers hand Fiona Hill and David Holmes this report. Mm-hmm. But Fiona Hill also did not back down. And she, as you mentioned, alleged that some lawmakers were given credence to this debunked theory that Ukraine was interfering in the 2016 and it was doing Russia's work.
Well, we're sure to hear from Republicans after the break. But on Fox News, Clinton impeachment prosecutor Ken Starr reacted to the testimony so far. Now, remember yesterday, he's the one who startled everybody by saying on Fox News that he thought it was a bombshell day. He thought, you know, maybe we might see senators walking over to the White House as they did during the Nixon era to ask for a president to step down. But here's what he said today.
Strong feelings, yes. Yelling into the phone, yes. Investigate the Bidens, yes. But was there, in fact, some sort of, quote, corrupt bargain? I just don't see the state of mind evidence there as yet.
Franco, that's probably what we'll hear from Republicans.
Yeah, they argued that the evidence is not conclusive, that it's all hearsay and firsthand information. They're also questioning whether the money was actually held up, arguing that in the end it was ultimately released.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, who's been following all of these hearings. Franco, we thank you so much.
Thank you.
And while it was an explosive day in Washington yesterday, there were also some interesting moments in Atlanta last night. 10 Democrats participated in their fifth debate, hosted by a panel of women moderators from The Washington Post and MSNBC. Let's get the highlights from NPR's political reporter Jessica Taylor. She joins us from Washington. And Jessica, last night seemed really more civil than contentious, but there were some back and forth moments with a few candidates. What were some big issues that stood out to you most?
It really did sort of start off slow. I wonder if the candidates were maybe as sleep deprived as some of us here in Washington
yeah.
were from watching the hearings. And they were asked about, you know, impeachment and Sondland's testimony early on. One thing that we didn't hear a lot about was typically these things have been almost consumed at the beginning of talk about the Medicare for All plans and the differences between them. But they got to a lot of different issues that we haven't heard in previous debates on housing issues, on affordable child care. So they really sort of were able to, I think, expand what they talked about. And Elizabeth Warren, center stage, she had the most speaking time still. But then you had other candidates that were sort of making late plays. Pete Buttigieg, the South Bend, Indiana mayor, he's been rising in the polls there. And it seemed like at first that, you know, we thought going in that, you know, candidates would try to attack him. He's sort of the rising front runner, at least in Iowa. But it was really sort of civil for the first 90 minutes.
That's right. So as you said, Buttigieg has been doing pretty well in the polls, which might explain why later in the night he was a target. Here's one jab he got from Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, who, like the mayor, is also a veteran.
I think the most recent example of your inexperience in national security and foreign policy came from your recent careless statement about how you as president would be willing to send our troops to Mexico to fight the cartels.
To which Buttigieg called Gabbard's criticism outlandish, and he said that she was taking him out of context.
I was talking about U.S.-Mexico cooperation. We've been doing security cooperation with Mexico for years. Do you seriously think anybody on this stage is proposing invading Mexico?
Jessica, I'm really curious, what are your thoughts on this exchange? How did Buttigieg handle that heat last night?
Well, I think this clash with Gabbard, I think, is instructive of sort of the differences that we see between her and the other candidates on foreign policy, because he had sort of a later retort to her saying that, you know, questioning her foreign policy worldview, she has really sort of advocated for, you know, she doesn't want to continue regime change wars, as she has said repeatedly. And he questioned her judgment after she has previously met with Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad. Gabbard has held far more conservative views on many things than the rest of the field. And she had another exchange later, earlier in the night with California Senator Kamala Harris, where she essentially accused her of being a Republican plant in a way, going on Fox News and criticizing Democrats. And that's the way a lot of Democrats sort of see her candidacy with this skepticism. So I think you saw sort of a real sort of tension there on stage between Gabbard and some of the other candidates.
Yeah, let's also talk about Biden last night. There were several verbal missteps. He called Senator Carol Mosley Braun the only black female senator, even though Senator Kamala Harris was standing a couple of feet away from him. I want to know, compared to candidates, he seemed to respond pretty subdued. He didn't respond as quickly as some of the others. Do you think these slip-ups will hurt him in the polls, especially with black voters, which was brought up a lot last night?
This is sort of the way we have seen him in these debates, and his support has remained, you know, fairly the same. I mean, he really sort of touted his support in the black community, and that is something that Buttigieg, for instance, really struggles with, and he had to answer questions about race and things. And Biden, we really haven't seen his support there erode. You know, even if he is lagging behind in Iowa and New Hampshire, his firewall sort of is there in South Carolina, the first early state that they will get to with a significant African-American population. He did sort of face some questions about this later on. But yeah, I mean, he has these verbal stumbles, but it really doesn't seem to make much of a difference.
Yeah, some other highlights. Senator Cory Booker, he struggled to stand out in the race. He had a few moments last night. But with just under a month, Democrats will be back to the sixth debate. What are the qualifications for it? And who's made the cut so far in the little time that we have with you?
So as it keeps going upward, they have to meet higher benchmarks. For December, they have to reach at least 4% in four polls or 6% in two early state polls, along with 200,000 unique donors. So who has made that so far is Biden, Buttigieg, Harris, Klobuchar, Sanders, and Warren. Tom Steyer, who is spent over $48 million of his own money in the race, wasn't, again, a player in his second debate, really. He has hit the polling benchmarks because he's been spending heavily in these early states. We're not sure yet if he has hit the donor benchmarks. And that's why I think you saw a last sort of gasp from Cory Booker, who had a very strong debate, seemed to his campaign said he that's raised right. a lot online. Will that be enough for him to get in the polls where he needs to?
He pushed a lot of people to his website last night. That's NPR's political reporter Jessica Taylor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We are following closely the news out of the impeachment hearings today. This is the last day of testimony this week. And we wanted to take this opportunity to step back and take a deeper look at the legal arguments for the impeachment of President Donald Trump. We have with us Barbara McQuaid, a former U.S. attorney appointed by President Obama. She's now professor at the University of Michigan Law School. And Barbara, let's start with a refresher on the language of the Constitution, which says that a president can be impeached for, quote, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Based on what you've heard, I'm really curious to know from you, do you expect articles of impeachment to be drawn up?
I do. I think whether that results in removal is a different question, but I think based on what we have seen and based on the opening and closing comments of Adam Schiff, who's the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, it appears to me that a very clear case can be made for articles of impeachment. I would imagine that they would include bribery, obstruction of justice, and abuse of power.
Yeah. Republicans have said that the aid Ukraine was seeking was eventually delivered, so there was no bribery. Do they have a point? Does attempted bribery carry the same weight as actual bribery?
It's such a great question because actual bribery is complete upon the demand. And so bribery occurred. It isn't even attempted bribery, regardless of whether the aid was released or the investigations announced. Bribery is defined as demanding a thing of value in exchange for the performance of an official act. The actus reus, so to speak, the bad act of the crime, is the demand. And so when President Trump made his demand, the bribery crime was completed at that moment. And there is harm that occurs then. Even though these things went through, people are saying no harm, no foul. The harm occurs upon the demand because the foreign aid that was deemed to be in our national interest was delayed. And it also harmed the reputation of the United States among its allies around the world. We want to be seen as a country that keeps its promises and that is committed to an anti-corruption agenda and that has integrity. And by making that demand, President Trump committed bribery and damaged the United States around the world.
Can we go back to the term that we were using before, bribery, quid pro quo? What about the argument that, hey, a quid pro quo did indeed happen, but as acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney actually said, that that's not an impeachable defense?
So quid pro quo is an element of bribery. It just means this for that. And so it is part of a bribery. So in this instance, the demand for the investigations in exchange for the performance of the official act, releasing the aid and granting a White House visit. What Mick Mulvaney has said, which I believe is going to be ultimately the Republican defense as the facts continue to come out and it becomes impossible to deny that there was a quid pro quo, is to instead embrace the facts and say, but that's not enough for impeachment. I think
right.
where his argument falls apart, though, is, you know, he wants to portray it as this is politics as usual. This is how countries negotiate with one another. And what we've heard from many people is that, no, it is not. This was not withholding aid to get something for the benefit of the United States as a country, as Joe Biden has done and was pointed out that he wanted to make sure that there were certain anti-corruption measures taken before we would agree to certain things, including the firing of the former public prosecutor. Instead, what this is President Trump demanding things that would help his own personal political interests. As we heard this morning from Fiona Hill, this theory that Ukraine was somehow involved in interfering with the 2016 election is a lie, it's propaganda, and it's being perpetrated by Russia. And so not only was there no benefit to the United States in President Trump's conduct, there was serious harm.
Let's talk a little bit about some more of that testimony. You talked about Fiona Hill's testimony today. Yesterday, U.S. Ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, said numerous times that, yes, there was a quid pro quo. But he also said that the president hadn't directly told him to the condition to the aid on investigation. Sondland took direction instead from Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer. Here's what the Republican counsel, Steve Castor, had to say about that.
You testified that Mr. Giuliani was expressing the desires of the president, correct?
That's our understanding, yes.
But how did you know that? Who told you?
Well, when the president says, talk to my personal attorney, and then Mr. Giuliani, as his personal attorney, makes certain requests or demands, we assume it's coming from the president. I'm not testifying that I heard the president tell Mr. Giuliani to tell us, so if that's your question.
Barbara, does this hurt the Democrats' case? I mean, that Sondland and other witnesses weren't directly told by the president to condition the aid or the White House meeting the investigations on the Bidens?
Certainly, it would be a stronger case if he could testify that President Trump told me directly that there was this direct link, or if it had been on videotape with President Trump saying this. But no cases are perfect. When I was prosecuting cases, we certainly prosecuted cases on far less evidence than this and were successful in obtaining guilty verdicts by a jury. The question in a jury case, in a criminal case, is guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't know what the standard will be here. It's whatever the Senate decides it is. But all reasonable doubt does not mean all possible doubt. Is it possible that space aliens were responsible for this theory as well? Well, maybe. Yeah. But what does your reason and common sense tell you? And a jury is instructed you may draw reasonable inferences based on the totality of the circumstances. And what do we have here? We have President, not only what Gordon Sondland told us, but what President Trump himself said in that July 25th call. When President Zelensky asked about military aid, President Trump's first response was, I need you to do me a favor, though. And then he launched into his request for investigations into the 2016 election and Biden. I think based on that, the text messages, what Rudy Giuliani was saying privately and publicly, it is well beyond proof, beyond a reasonable doubt, that these two things were linked, and it was President Trump's wish that he used the military aid and the White House visit as leverage to obtain these investigations.
Okay, I want to ask you about another potential article of impeachment that intelligence chair, Democrat Adam Schiff, brought up yesterday. Let's listen.
We can see why Secretary Pompeo and President Trump have made such a concerted and across-the-board effort to obstruct this investigation and this impeachment inquiry. And I will just say this, they do so at their own peril. I remind the president that Article 3 of the impeachment articles drafted against President Nixon was his refusal to obey the subpoenas of Congress.
Okay, do the Democrats have a strong case for obstruction of justice?
I think they do. I think they have a very strong case for obstruction of justice. President Trump early on said something to the effect of, I'm going to fight all the subpoenas. A president has a right to invoke executive privilege in certain circumstances, and I think even has a duty to do that to protect the institution and the office of the presidency. But when you invoke it as to everything, basically crying wolf, you are damaging that executive privilege for all presidents who will come after. In this instance, by not permitting John Bolton and Michael Pompeo and others to come testify, they are preventing Congress from exercising its constitutional oversight. And as we all know, the Constitution is designed to create a government of checks and balances. And President Trump is trying to thwart the efforts of Congress to serve as an effective check here. And
question for you there. I have a question for you there. I mean, is there any legal process which can open up the ability for us to hear from Bolton, for instance?
There is. And right now, I think they're putting their eggs in the Don McGahn basket. Don McGahn is someone who also defied a subpoena to testify before Congress. A lawsuit was filed to enforce that subpoena in court. And after the hearing that went quite well for the Democrats, they withdrew some of the other subpoenas. My speculation is that they're waiting to get a ruling from that particular judge in hopes for a favorable outcome, rather than litigating each and every one of these witnesses in front of a dozen different judges and perhaps getting different results. Getting this one result. Now, the problem here is it is likely that President Trump would appeal to the Second Circuit Court of D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and then appeal that to the Supreme Court. And they're racing the clock a little bit here with the election looming in November. Delays of months probably isn't going to cut it in this scenario. So it may be that President Trump's stall tactic works in some regard. But I think when Adam Schiff said you do so at your own peril, I think the risk is that when you don't want people to know the facts, it suggests it's because you're afraid of the facts. In the law, we refer to that as consciousness of guilt. I am concealing the truth because I believe that revelation of the truth will be damning.
With a few minutes that I have with you, I want to ask you about witness intimidation. President Trump criticized U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, very quickly. I mean, could this also be a factor in the articles of impeachment?
I think it could. My guess is it wouldn't be a standalone, but it could be part of the article for obstruction of justice. Witness tampering and witness intimidation falls under the umbrella of obstruction of justice because the purpose is to intimidate people from telling the truth by facing these repercussions and consequences and threats. And Maria Yovanovitch herself said that she felt intimidating. Yeah. And there's also the potential to intimidate other witnesses who are on the witness list who have not yet appeared to testify. The reason I would include it in the articles of impeachment is the importance of deterrence. We want to send a message that this is not okay from our president.
Barbara McQuaid, former U.S. attorney and professor at the University of Michigan Law School, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
As the impeachment clock is ticking in the United States, Ukraine is in a race to fix a broken system before time runs out.
It's just frightening because it's fast.
A new look at the country on the other side of the impeachment scandal on Rough Translation from NPR.
Staying with politics, sort of, Georgia's Democratic Congressman Hank Johnson told TMZ that Congress might be able to take action against the NFL for the way quarterback Colin Kaepernick has been treated. This was after last Saturday's frankly weird tryout for the free agent who hasn't played in the NFL since the 2016 season. You remember that's when he started kneeling during the national anthem to protest police brutality against African Americans. He's accused the league of colluding to keep him out, and that suspicion apparently extended to this weird tryout. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. And Mike, for those who didn't follow this on Saturday, what happened in this weird tryout?
Yeah, it was hard to follow. First of all, the tryout was supposed to be, and it was hastily arranged, it was supposed to be at the Atlanta Falcons facility. And if you're saying, even if you're not a big NFL fan, Saturday, wait, don't the teams play on Sunday? Mm-hmm. Indeed, they do. And usually tryouts are a Tuesday. But because of the hastily arranged nature, it was thrown together on a Saturday. And then, and we could get into this, due to a kerfuffle, which people who've looked at the contract said is kind of legitimate. Kaepernick's team was a little alarmed by what the NFL wanted him to sign. Kaepernick pulled out of that tryout, went to a high school in the Atlanta area, put the tryout on YouTube, and I think eight or most of the 11 teams who were going to look at the tryout in the Falcons facility did show up, but it was a much lesser and clearly unleague-sanctified tryout.
Yeah,
sanctioned
it was
tryout.
Like, where's Waldo? You know, where is he? And, you know, the purpose is for teams to see him and, you know, maybe he'd be signed. But look, in your mind, should he be playing football?
Was that the purpose, though, I would ask?
Oh.
Or was the purpose the NFL to sort of indemnify themselves for future lawsuits? And that is what Team Kaepernick says, and it's quite plausible. It's just such a weird tryout. Mm. Can he play? Yeah, he absolutely. Well, look, he hasn't played in 3 years, so we can't say absolutely. But I go back to the fact that if you look at the statistics of every player who's ever, every quarterback who's ever played the game, no one has had better statistics than Colin Kaepernick, who didn't retire, leave football because of injury, or there was one case of a gambling addiction. Okay. Yeah. So he is, and this is a starting quarterback. He definitely could be a backup somewhere if it just went by legs and arm and football brain. There's something else going on, and that something else is why the league paid him a couple $1 million because of a collusion
lawsuit.
Well,
so this is explaining this for the first time for me, because he did settle a suit earlier this year with the NFL, and so you're saying that the reason for this weird, we'll give you a tryout on a weird day, Saturday, when maybe no one will be there, is to, as you say, inoculate themselves, indemnify themselves against another lawsuit. They don't really want him to play.
Yes.
And he's hugely popular. He's got the Kaepernick shoe coming out in December with Nike. Nike stock shot up 18% since its deal with him. It does seem like he's being blacklisted, blackballed.
Well, I think the evidence is quite clear that there's no football reason he's not playing. He's hugely popular, but he's also hugely unpopular, and he seems to be unpopular among the constituency of 32, which is the owners of NFL teams. And you can make a case, it might not be the most exalted or socially conscious case, but you can make a case that, look, if we were to accept this guy on our team, he'd be a backup quarterback, and he would be a distraction. Fairly or unfairly, he would be a distraction. Teams don't want that. I don't know if Colin Kaepernick will ever play again.
Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, host of the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Thank you for explaining it to us.
You're welcome.
And now some key moments from today's impeachment inquiry hearings. Fiona Hill, a former National Security Council senior director for Europe and Russia, and David Holmes, an aide to the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine, testifying before the House Intelligence Committee, both offered firsthand accounts of the Trump administration's unorthodox diplomacy with Ukraine that Democrats say provide more evidence bolstering their case that President Trump attempted to pressure Ukraine's president into launching investigations into his political rival and into a baseless claim that Ukraine, not Russia, intervened in the 2016 election. In her opening statement, Hill chastised those Republican members of the committee, fueling what she called those false narratives.
Based on questions and statements I have heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. The unfortunate truth is that Russia was the foreign power that systematically attacked our democratic institutions in 2016. This is the public conclusion of our intelligence agencies, confirmed in bipartisan congressional reports. It is beyond dispute, even if some of the underlying details must remain classified. The impact of the successful 2016 Russian campaign remains evident today. Our nation is being torn apart. Truth is questioned. Our highly professional and expert Korea Foreign Service is being undermined. U.S. support for Ukraine, which continues to face armed Russian aggression, has been politicized. The Russian government's goal is to weaken our country, to diminish America's global role, and to neutralize a perceived U.S. threat to Russian interests. President Putin and the Russian security services aim to counter U.S. foreign policy objectives in Europe, including in Ukraine, where Moscow wishes to reassert political and economic dominance. I say this not as an alarmist, but as a realist. I do not think long-term conflict with Russia is either desirable or inevitable. I continue to believe that we need to seek ways of stabilizing our relationship with Moscow, even as we counter their efforts to harm us. Right now, Russia's security services and their proxies have geared up to repeat their interference in the 2020 election. We are running out of time to stop them. In the course of this investigation, I would ask that you please not promote politically driven falsehoods that so clearly advance Russian interests.
And David Holmes described the moment when he and his colleagues at the U.S. Embassy in Kiev learned that the White House froze nearly $400 million of military aid to Ukraine and how he came to understand why.
Given the history of U.S. security assistance to Ukraine and the bipartisan recognition of its importance, I was shocked when on July 18th, an Office of Management and Budget staff member surprisingly announced the hold on Ukraine security assistance. The announcement came toward the end of a nearly two-hour National Security Council secure video conference call, which I participated in from the embassy conference room. The official said that the order had come from the president and had been conveyed to OMB by Mr. Mulvaney with no further explanation. This began a week or so of efforts by various agencies to identify the rationale for the freeze, to conduct a review of the assistance, and to reaffirm the unanimous view of the Ukraine policy community of its importance. NSC counterparts confirmed to us that there had been no change in our Ukraine policy, but could not determine the cause of the hold or how to lift it. On July 25th, President Trump made a congratulatory phone call to President Zelensky after his party won a commanding majority in Ukraine's parliamentary election. Contrary to standard procedure, the embassy received no readout of that call, and I was unaware of what was discussed until the transcript was released on September 25th. Upon reading the transcript, I was deeply disappointed to see that the president raised none of what I understood to be our interagency agreed upon foreign policy priorities in Ukraine, and instead raised the Biden-Burisma investigation and referred to the theory about CrowdStrike and its supposed connection to Ukraine in the 2016 election.
CrowdStrike was the company that found that Russia hacked the 2016 election. Conspiracy theorists think Ukraine did it, not true. Holmes also offered his account of the July 26 phone call between President Trump and EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland, which Holmes overheard at a restaurant in Ukraine.
I then took the opportunity to ask Ambassador Sondland for his candid impression of the president's views on Ukraine. In particular, I asked Ambassador Sondland if it was true that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland agreed that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. I asked why not, and Ambassador Sondland stated that the president only cares about big stuff. I noted there was big stuff going on in Ukraine, like a war with Russia. And Ambassador Sondland replied that he meant big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing.
Well, then Committee Chair Adam Schiff asked Holmes whether the Trump administration pressured Ukraine for investigations that could benefit Trump politically.
So you're acknowledging, I think, Mr. Holmes, are you not, that Ukraine very much felt pressured to undertake these investigations that the president, Rudy Giuliani, and Ambassador Sondland and others were demanding?
Yes, sir. And although the hold on the security assistance may have been lifted, there were still things they wanted that they weren't getting, including a meeting with the president in the Oval Office. Whether the hold, the security assistance hold continued or not, Ukrainians understood that that's something the president wanted, and they still wanted important things from the president. So and I think that continues to this day. I think they're being very careful. They still need us now going forward. In fact, right now, President Zelensky is trying to arrange a summit meeting with President Putin in the coming weeks, to his first face-to-face meeting with him to try to advance the peace process. He needs our support. He needs President Putin to understand that America supports Zelensky at the highest levels. So this doesn't end with the lifting of the security assistance hold. Ukraine still needs us and, as I said, still fighting this war this very day.
Well, the Democrats' lawyer, Daniel Goldman, also pressed Fiona Hill about a July 10th meeting when she says National Security Advisor John Bolton told her that he was not part of whatever drug deal Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up.
Do you recall what you said?
Yes.
What he said to you, rather?
I do recall, yes. It was part of a conversation about the things that Mr. Giuliani was saying very frequently in public. We saw them often on television making these statements. And I had already brought to Ambassador Bolton's attention the attacks, the smear campaign against Ambassador Yovanovitch, and expressed great regret about how this was unfolding and, in fact, the shameful way in which Ambassador Yovanovitch was being smeared and attacked. And I'd asked if there was anything that we could do about it. And Ambassador Bolton had looked pained, basically indicated with body language that there was nothing which we could do about it. And he then, in the course of that discussion, said that Rudy Giuliani was a hand grenade that was going to blow everyone up.
Did you understand what he meant by that?
I did, actually.
What did he mean?
Well, I think he meant that, obviously, what Mr. Giuliani was saying was pretty explosive in any case. He was frequently on television making quite incendiary remarks about everyone involved in this, and that he was clearly pushing forward issues and ideas that would, probably come back to haunt us. And, in fact, I think that that's where we are today.
Devin Nunes, the committee's ranking Republican, used his opening remarks today to attack the impeachment inquiry itself.
Throughout these bizarre hearings, the Democrats have struggled to make the case that President Trump committed some impeachable offense on his phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky. The offense itself changes depending on the day, ranging from quid pro quo to extortion to bribery to obstruction of justice, then back to quid pro quo. It's clear why the Democrats have been forced onto this carousel of accusations. President Trump had good reason to be wary of Ukrainian election meddling against his campaign and of widespread corruption in that country. President Zelensky, who didn't even know aid to Ukraine had been paused at the time of the call, has repeatedly said there was nothing wrong with the conversation. The aid was resumed without the Ukrainians taking the actions they were supposedly being coerced into doing. Aid to Ukraine under President Trump has been much more robust than it was under President Obama, thanks to the provision of Javelin anti-tank weapons. As numerous witnesses have testified, temporary holds on foreign aid occur fairly frequently for many different reasons. So how do we have an impeachable offense here when there's no actual misdeed and no one even claiming to be a victim?
And we will continue to follow today's hearings throughout the program. Stay tuned.
Bolivia's interim president, Yanini Áñez, wants Congress there to approve new elections as violence there continues. Áñez assumed power after President Evo Morales resigned earlier this month. An election in October was shown to have multiple irregularities. Morales said he won that election, but the military pressured him to step down. He was in power for 14 years and was Bolivia's first indigenous president. More than 30 people have died in the unrest that followed the election. NPR's international correspondent Philip Reeves was in Bolivia until a couple of days ago and now joins us from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. Hi, Philip.
Hi.
So we're hearing in the last couple of days at least 17 protesters have been killed during clashes with security forces, and witnesses are telling reporters that police and soldiers are firing into crowds. I can only imagine what impact this is having on the ongoing crisis.
Yes, I mean, it's really ratcheting up tensions. These are incidents of the kind that tend to form the timeline of a crisis and get remembered forever. It's deepening divisions in a very polarized society. The latest of these happened in a city called El Alto, that's right by the de facto capital, La Paz. It happened at a major fuel depot, which serves about 2 million people. It's been blockaded by Morales' supporters for some days, and the army and police decided that they wanted to break that blockade because there are fuel shortages. There were confrontations that left 8 people dead, 30 injured. As you say, relatives are telling reporters that forces opened fire on them, but the defense ministry is saying that they were facing an attack on the plant and that people had planted some dynamite around the walls and there could have been a major catastrophe. Whatever happens, both versions will probably never be reconciled, and the impression among Morales' supporters is that there is what Morales himself calls a massacre that's taken place. There was an incident on Friday in which 9 people were killed. These are coca farmers. Police fired into a crowd there. So in just those 2 incidents, 17 people at least have been killed, and that's more than half the total number of deaths in the last month of unrest.
Okay, let's go back a little bit. This unrest in Bolivia started out about a month ago as a protest against Morales, and now we're seeing protests calling for him to come back. What happened there?
Well, a lot of Morales' supporters were particularly enraged by the arrival on the scene as interim president of Yanini Áñez. She's a little-known senator who was fifth in line for the succession. She's a religious conservative. And initially, Morales' supporters were unhappy about the manner in which she proclaimed herself interim president. She did so in Congress without a quorum. She now has some legal backing for that. But many of Morales' supporters, if you talk to them on the streets, still challenge her legitimacy. And now we've had these incidents of the use of deadly force against crowds, and that is feeding their opposition. They're also unhappy because her government's passed a decree that gives the security forces, in effect, immunity from prosecution when they use force against protesters. If you add all of that together, then you get the phenomenon that we're seeing now, which is people taking to the streets, asking for Morales to come back.
There's also this other issue. Morales' support comes primarily from indigenous people. And Áñez, she actually has said many things about indigenous people that make people fearful.
Yeah, there's some evidence of tweets which were later deleted, which were considered to be very hostile to indigenous people, described by them as racist. She's seen as this vanguard of conservative Christian people who are hostile to their cultural beliefs, and they see that as a threat to their rights and a threat to the plurinationalist state that Morales created.
Áñez has also severed ties with Maduro's government in Venezuela, kicking out Cuban doctors and Venezuelan diplomats.
Yes, and this speaks to the feeling among Morales' supporters and just critics of the interim government that the role of an interim government is to guide a country towards elections in times like this of crisis, and that there is a sense that Yanini Áñez is taking the country in a right-wing direction at a time when she should be pursuing policies that are essentially neutral and focused on the business of getting Bolivia to elections in an extremely difficult environment.
Yeah, this sounds so chaotic in the day-to-day as well. How is this impacting people there in Bolivia?
Well, there are fuel shortages, there are food shortages, there are long lines of people waiting to buy chicken and bread and eggs and so on in La Paz, the capital. There's a lot of fear. And emotions are running very high. I was very struck interviewing people how often people would burst into tears. Vigilante groups have arisen in various neighborhoods. There's even talk among some people that this could be a country that is, if not checked now, could be heading towards civil war.
Oh, gosh. Has there been any international response?
Yes. I mean, the interim government of Yanini Áñez has been recognized by the U.S. and by Britain and others. But much of the region here is waiting to see what happens with a lot of concern. And meanwhile, human rights organizations are beginning to speak out about all these reports that they're opening fire on crowds.
That's NPR international correspondent Philip Reeves. Thank you for this update, Philip.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is